Look, I actually don't think it's as bad as what I expected before I started practicing. I mean, I used to, for some reason, have the impression that like lots of people would find it really difficult to comply. But I don't know the stats, but I would say based on my gut feeling, like probably around 90% of my patients kind of okay. Like they comply. No, I don't know for sure whether they comply with exactly 20 to 22 hours a day, which is what I prescribe, but clinically, when they come back and I look at whether it's tracking or not, I'd say most patients would have no issue.
Welcome to the CPD Junkie Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Sean Wing, for the Ask the Expert segment. You can find out more about me on my Instagram handle at Dr. Sean W. So, introducing today's special guest, Dr. Joshua Chung, who is also a practicing orthodontist in Metropolitan Melbourne, and he graduated in Melbourne University, both bachelor and specialist DCD in orthodontics. He completed his fellowship in Royal Australian College of Dental Surgeons, being awarded the Kenneth Sutherland Prize, and he also lectures at Melbourne University. Very excited and thankful to have you here, Dr. Joshua Chung. How are you today?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Sean. It's been a long day, but for you as well, I'm sure. But yeah, no, I'm excited to be a part of this podcast.
Thank you so much for taking your time. I know we're always, leading very busy lives, and I'm sure you are as well. But I guess, yeah, look, our exposure, I feel like our exposure to orthodontics as university graduates is relatively limited. Did you always know you wanted to be an orthodontist?
No, I didn't. I didn't, to be honest. I mean, like when I first graduated, I just wanted to be a good general dentist, and so I worked. My first job was in Dandenong Dentist, and so I worked there for a good 3 to 4 years. And then I think during as I was working there, I always sort of thought, how can I improve myself, as a clinician, which I'm sure all about. Here, like listeners can relate to. And so for me, there were a few different things, but I wanted to, I always had the idea that I want to upskill. And so I started up, I did the RACDS primaries again with the intention of being a better general dentist. And I then did the secondaries for the same reason. But I think through the process of sitting those exams and meeting other like candidates who really wanted to specialize. I mean, I think that's when I maybe first started to think about the idea of specialization. And it definitely wasn't always orthodontics. I mean, I was at the time thinking about possibly doing perio, or applying for perio, or applying to ortho, or even staying a GP, because I was honestly quite happy to be a GP. I know some specialists say they hate doing, whatever area of dentistry and they want to get away from. But I didn't really have that, and so, and then so it was through a process of observing, different specialists, talking to them. I went to shadow a few different orthodontists, shadowed a few different, periodontists and a few other people, and at the end, decided to give orthodontics a go. I thought that, I liked the continuity, in the sense that continuity of care, and that you see the patient. And not just once and you fix the issue and they sort of go away, but you're seeing them, roughly every, possibly 4 to 8 weeks. So you build that relationship with them, and I liked that aspect. There's of course the the problem solving aspect. I think we all know that there's a lot of treatment planning with orthodontics, particularly at the start of treatment and throughout as well. So I did want something that required that. And it just seemed cool. I don't know. The field just seemed cool, and I just wanted to learn about it. But I didn't know for sure. And even when I got into postgrad, it's a silly idea now that I think back on it. But I thought, I don't even know that I want to be an orthodontist. I kind of thought I just want to do orthodontics. I'll see how it goes. And worst case scenario, I can go back to being a GP, and I've done orthodontics course. I can still offer orthodontic treatment to my patients. So that was my mindset. Going into orthodontics at Melbourne.
Oh, so that's very interesting. So you actually didn't know until, or even after you did your RACDS, and that influenced you to try to, think about specializing.
For sure. Even during the course of postgrad, like maybe I'd say by second year, I knew like, okay, well, I'm in this pretty deep now, and I think I will work as an orthodontist. But honestly, like when I started orthodontics, I wasn't, because I didn't know what it was about. I think it's hard when you're not, I think orthodontics is maybe the one area in uni where you're not really treating patients orthodontically. So
Right.
you know, so I didn't maybe have enough exposure to it at the time. But I mean, I'm happy, and I think now that I'm in it, there's so much to orthodontics, and I'm realizing that like in every area of dentistry, there's just so much to learn. And even like I'm around three, this is my fourth year out now, and I still feel like there's so much, you know, so much to learn. So there's enough in there for me to you know, to I can focus on. I mean, there's so many areas that I can develop in.
Do you ever miss any GP aspects? Like, what do you miss? Like, do you miss doing a crown prep or anything like that?
I actually miss doing like fissure sealants. I don't know. I love doing fissure sealants. I know it's, you know, maybe not the hardest sort of thing to do, but it was just relaxed. No, I mean, I liked all aspects of dentistry. You know, I did like I liked the variety. You know, I liked you know, I liked. I mean, part of me liked endo, even though it was a little bit challenging at times. And so maybe I missed the variety more than any specific part of dentistry. But look, I think it's all sort of related in a way, and you know, we get a lot of interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary type cases where I've got to put on different hats and try to think from the perspective of a GP and try to remember like what I, you know, things I used to think about. So yeah, so it's fine.
That's interesting. I think you mentioned that you actually went to Michigan for one of your research projects regarding like 3D image analysis. And obviously, with new AI advancements, like what do you think has been the biggest improvement for orthodontics in relation to, technology or AI or anything like that?
Look, AI is a, you know, very big topic, and I think that in orthodontics there are so many different aspects. I mean, speaking from the with regards to things that affect me on a day-to-day basis, you know, I use a program called WebCEPH where I upload my lateral cephs in, you know, into the program. And you know, in uni, I remember we the first I think the first day we had to hand trace our lat cephs. You know, we had to put the tracing paper and plot all the points and then draw, you know, or you know, draw, you know, do all the tracings, and it's very, very time consuming. Nowadays, you know, I can upload it onto WebCEPH, and then it'll digitize the ceph automatically. It'll plot the points, it'll plot all the lines, it'll do all the measurements and spit it out for me. And sometimes, if you know, if I'm a bit time poor, I can even potentially have staff help to do that, so I could just sort of walk in and just look at it. So that's definitely one aspect. Of course, intraoral scanners. You know, again, when I first started doing Invisalign, I'd use the PVS impressions, and you know, and then I missed the seven or something, and I have to redo it, and then it's just, you know. Anyway, we all know the, you know, the issues with that. But you know, intraoral scanners has you know, that's a big one. The ability to be able to superimpose, you know, the STL files is something that I started kind of doing that recently. You know, sometimes I'm interested in seeing, you know, treatment effects, like the effect that my treatment has had on patients. And yes, you can use, you know, photos, but I tried to, you know, superimpose them using Medit and then generating like color maps. So that's a pretty cool sort of way to assess what's happening. And then back to CBCT, which was kind of related to my research. It was an amazing experience for me to go to Michigan and meet people I read about, you know, Lucia Sevidanez, Antonio Ruelas, who done a lot of work on superimposing CBCT. And so for my research project, you know, I looked at the dento-alveolar effects of the Herbst appliance, you know, that the fixed class two functional corrector. And a lot of, you know, research has been done on it in the past with 2D lat cephs. And so, but of course, we know that with 2D, there's limitations, you know, there's superimposition error, distortion, things like that. And so I flew all the way to Michigan, and it was a very long flight, but it was really good as well, because Prof Schneider, who was convener at the time, he was very, very hospitable. Like he went to Michigan with me. We had a night in New York, so that was amazing. And yeah, treated me to dinner and things like that. So really good experience. But then when I got to Michigan, yeah, the guys were again very generous with their knowledge. You know, I spent about 2 weeks with the PhD students who taught me step by step how to carry out voxel-based superimposition.
Mm.
Very, very time consuming, I have to say. Like I was in the lab for, 10 hours a day sort of thing, superimposing these CBCTs. But yeah, anyway, like I think that, I mean, in terms of the AI and to answer the question, I think, in the future, if we can find, I know there's still work being done to verify the, accuracy of this, but if you could have a program like, say, Dolphin, automatically superimpose CBCTs, that will help you to do all sorts of things like monitor growth, see what effects your treatment has had, your Invisalign treatment has had on patients. If it can be done, as I said, in a quick way that's convenient to busy clinicians, like I think that'd be very, very helpful. So yeah, I mean those are some of the things.
Yeah, so pretty much you'd be superimposing this data, like each data point, to see how effective your treatment is, or is it actually working? Like all these
Yeah.
advances, all these new ideas, is it like real, or is it just like what we
That's
see?
right.
That's
That's
interesting.
right. Because sometimes it's hard because based on photos, it's very, very, very hard to tell what effect something has. Like if you take a class 2 malocclusion and you have a before and after photo, you might show that it's been corrected. But how has it been corrected? Has it been corrected by moving the lower arch forwards, or is it the upper arch backwards and with distalization?
Yeah, it was just the
And
rotation of the sixes. Who knows?
yeah, or that, yeah, exactly. And so you don't really know for sure unless you can superimpose on a stable landmark.
Yeah.
And I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to kind of verify what is stable and that's yeah. But anyway, I think yeah, very it's
Got
an exciting area.
Yeah. And especially, I guess, in terms of aligners. Because
Yeah.
everything's so digital these days, there's so much data that we can collect, and therefore AI and aligners seem to be going really well together. What are your thoughts as an orthodontist with, aligners exploding into in popularity and all the patients wanting aligners? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think aligners definitely have their place, and there's obviously very, very strong demand for cosmetic appliances. There are more and more adults who are seeking orthodontic treatment. And so clear aligners clearly have a very, a big role to play in treating those patients. Yeah, look, I think that the clear aligners, can treat a very wide range of cases. I think there's still biomechanical difficulties with treating certain cases. And look, the technology is constantly improving, so who knows where it'll be, in the future. But I think for me, personally, I'd certainly offer a lot of clear aligner therapy, and even for those patients where the treatment is quite difficult and traditionally thought to be a case that could only be treated with braces, for example, extraction cases, deep bite cases. These days, I will, give patients the option of hybrid treatment, where, for example, with an extraction case, I'll say, look, the gold standard is braces. There's no question that you need to close an extraction space and to move teeth, sort of bodily. Braces are very, very sort of predictable. But with clear aligners, sometimes that can happen, but often, you get some side effects of like teeth tipping into extraction spaces, and it's very likely at some point during your treatment, I will need to put on some braces. I will try to keep it away from the front, but we will just need that to do the heavy lifting to help us. And so I think the combination, can make, clear aligners an option for patients who say need more, who have slightly more complex like malocclusions.
Yeah, like the best of
So,
both worlds.
yeah, the best of both worlds is not saying, because some of them would say, look, if that's the case, if you're saying it's braces or nothing, then I'm maybe not going to get treated. Like they might say that.
Yeah.
But I think it's at the same time, of course, it's informed consent. It's not sort of overpromising and saying, hey, we can do everything with clear aligners, and sort of compromising on the result, but just sort of pointing out, hey, I can do this with clear aligners, but there are some limitations here. And I think if patients are prepared to accept those limitations, or maybe accept hybrid treatment, then I think that's a good way that they can still have the treatment. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
What would be like, let's say a patient comes in and then they're like, Josh or Dr. Chung, I definitely want aligners. And then in your mind, you're like, you're definitely not getting aligners. It won't work. Like, what kind of cases would you be thinking? Like, what would they be at the moment?
So for example, I mean there would be some like that, like let's just say so I no, just to clarify, there are certain extraction cases that I would take on with clear aligners and always give the caveat that there's a strong possibility we may need to do braces. Now there are some other extraction cases that I probably wouldn't really do. Like for example, if there were missing like sixes or something, and you had to, and we wanted to like orthodontically close those spaces, then I probably wouldn't try those. I do think TADs have a role to play. Like, there's certain now that we have TAD mechanics that can be quite predictable. Sometimes that can treat some of these really difficult cases. Like for example, I think I had a patient who. Who's class two, had a big overjet, upper teeth were really far forwards. They'd already had upper premolar extractions. And so, I wasn't going to extract more teeth. They didn't want surgery and so on. And so for that patient, we used TADs. So now without a photo, it's a bit hard to sort of describe this to our audience, but basically we put in a couple of TADs in the anterior palate and we hooked it up to this framework. In the upper, and then we use the TADs to distalize the sixes, and then so we're doing that with Invisalign at the same time.
It's
So that,
almost like a distal jet appliance,
yeah,
but
exactly, like a distal jet, but it's connected to the TADs, in the anterior palate. So I mean that's something cool that there's certain, I mean in the past, like 20 years ago, maybe we would have just said, like we can't do it, but
That's cool. Yeah, that's fair enough. And it makes sense. Like these like posterior extraction cases could be very challenging for aligners. Yeah, I mean even for braces probably as well. Cool. Do you place TADs yourself or do you tend to send it to your perio?
Look, I think maybe I'm at the stage in my career where I kind of want to try I want to try everything and I want to do everything myself. So at the moment I am doing them myself. I quite enjoy it. I would say the TADs that I tend to do, I do like a lot of like during our training we were heavily influenced by Benedict Wilms and so the Benny Slider, placing TADs in the anterior palate, I find very very predictable. They like very rarely fail, and then we can connect them to that Benny Slider appliance, which basically helps us to distalize molars if we need to. It can help us to mesialize molars. Like I've had cases where if they're missing, say, upper laterals, and then we wanted to, and they had lots of spacing, and we wanted to pull all the back teeth forwards. That's been really good for that. In the lower arch, sometimes I place buccal shelf TADs as well. So I've used that to correct scissor bites. Use that to distalize the lower arch with mixed success, I have to say, in my hands. I mean and there are a few other applications, but
It brings out that periodontal specialist that you didn't end up
yeah
getting.
maybe that's the only sort of surgery, that's the only time I'll really have to like not numb people up.
That's
So
right.
we've got to get, I mean we've got honestly, like we don't have ready access to LA. Like we've got to, we know that we have to place TADs, we
Okay.
have to sort of look for it, whereas when I was working as a GP, be right next to me and I could just to fish it out exactly when I needed it. But yeah, look, it's good. And I think that's good. I mean, it goes back to the thing I was saying before about, my concerns that orthodontics will be really like a really narrow kind of specialty where I was sort of locked into one, just doing sort of one field of dentistry, and it get boring and so on. I think it is quite broad.
I've got some, recent grads that reached out with some questions, and hoping you can answer some of these. First question, I think early interceptive orthodontics on 5 to 6 year olds, that they feel like is it actually necessary? Do you think it's over treatment? What are your thoughts on that?
So the official, you know, orthodontics, the guidelines, sort of generally say that you know, patients should present at around age 7 to 8, on the basis that certain traditionally recommended early interventions such as, you know, reversible headgear work better at that age rather than later. Look, I'm interested to see, you know, how the research develops, and I think that when we talk about things like the etiology of malocclusion, I do think I think it's without question that say muscle dysfunction can play a role in that. For example, improper tongue posture, like if the tongue is sort of too far forwards or it's not high enough, that can impact on craniofacial growth. I think that I think there's no question that there's something going on between you know, airways and growth as well. Patients, you know, who mouth breathe, that, you know, we think that there's definitely a link there. I think I do think that you know, I'm keen to see how the research develops in sort of having a clinically predictable way of sort of altering you know, altering growth at that age. Yeah, look, I think in theory, you know, it is possible that dealing with those etiologies could change the way you know, the face and the jaws grow. But yeah, I think we just need to see a little bit more
Yeah.
evidence as it emerges. Yeah.
So as like a general dentist, let's say if we see a 5 to 6 year old during our routine checkup, like what would you typically say? Like what type of malocclusion would you say that, oh, maybe you should refer to an orthodontist to have a look? Is there a certain type of cases, or what do you recommend?
Yeah, look, for me at the moment, I'm still saying around 7 to 8. You know, I still, for me, that's sort of when I would want to see them. For me, it would be class 3. You know, like if they've got an underbite, you know, I'd want to see them early in case we would recommend reversible headgear, which works better at, you know, at an early age rather than, you know, say 10 to 12. Class 2 malocclusion, I think there's no harm in sending that early. And then if there are certain indications to treat early, for example, if there's a trauma risk involved, like, you know, for some patients with severe overjet, we would take a sort of a thorough history to see, you know, are they playing sports? I've had patients who do jiu-jitsu, you know, there's a sort of a high risk
Yeah.
patient, up incisors, you know, very proclined. You know, that would be an indication to treat early. If there's psychosocial reasons, like, you know, if the getting teased, you know, let's just say they've got a huge overjet and they're getting teased at school, and they really want they're really wanting sort of treatment very soon and not wanting to wait until they're, you know, 12 to 13 years old. I think that those cases would benefit, especially in the short term. Yeah, so those would be the case. And of course, you know, if there's crowding and you know, there's no harm in sending that over to see whether, you know, we'd consider early, say, extraction of primary teeth. Those would be a few cases.
Fair enough. You did mention like what reversible headgear. How
Yeah.
keen are parents for their kids to, you know, wear this kind of stuff going on,
Yeah.
and like are they quite receptive to it, or are they
I
like
think it depends.
not
I think it depends. I really think it depends. Like, I mean, not to stereotype,
interested?
but okay, well, I maybe won't say this, but certain cultures, you know, I think are more maybe receptive to
Right.
reversible headgear. And I think, I mean, there is research to show that it does decrease the chance of you know, needing surgery in the future.
Yeah.
And so on that basis, I think when that's presented, but of course, no guarantee. So I think when that's presented to parents, you know, they'll, if they're very, very keen to at all costs sort of avoid surgery, and they're willing to go through a protracted treatment, like early treatment followed by braces, and still possibly need surgery, I mean, I think that, you know, they could be convinced to do it. But yeah, I think you're right. Like, I've always had hard times with convincing patients to do it. Yeah, it's not
Not
easy.
fun. But I mean, headgear's been around for a very, very long time, right? So has there been any advances at all? Like is there a way to look make it look less invasive or more pretty? I don't know. Is there such thing?
I don't know. Like, to be honest, I mean, talking to other orthodontists about this, I feel like it's becoming less and less popular. I have to say, I don't know. I don't know the stats on it, but I'd say there are a lot of orthodontists that I wouldn't say they don't do it, but because it's the uptake is so low, and it's hard to convince patients to go with headgear. I mean, I've had patients who I think when I first started practicing, I said, hey, like, you should consider headgear for your case. And they went to get a second opinion, they end up doing something else with somebody else. So
I feel
I think that's one aspect.
yeah.
But it works. Like, it works in certain cases for sure. So without getting into the specifics, yeah, it can work.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see if there's any possible ways in the future to somehow use the extra, oral skeletal anchorage to utilize that without using a headgear. Maybe there could be new ideas at some point.
I mean, look, I find it actually sometimes easy to convince patients to do TADS. So if your goal is to try to, say, distalize the upper arch, or to stop natural mesial drift of the upper arch, then funnily enough, I found it easier to convince patients to do TADS distalized than I have to get them to wear headgear. So I don't think we necessarily do it to restrict maxillary growth. And yes, you get it in the short term, which helps, but I don't think people would do it for long-term restraint of maxillary growth, which I don't think actually occurs. So it's mainly for the dental effects that we would sort of do headgear. And I think, as I was saying, I think there are other ways that I can convince patients to do to get the same sort of outcome. So
No, that's fair enough.
yeah.
And you did also mention a little bit about like airway orthodontics. I know it's a little bit controversial, but you believe that by, changing people's teeth and stuff, that can potentially affect their airway. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
So by changing the teeth affect the area. Yeah, look, I certainly I think there's evidence to show that. I mean, definitely in patients who have so kids who have been diagnosed with, say, obstructive sleep apnea or somewhere along the spectrum, if they present with a high and narrow arched palate. Usually, aside from the airways, there would be lots of orthodontic reasons to treat that and to expand the upper arch. But I do think it definitely has benefits in sort of widening the nasal cavity. Of course, I think there's lots of research to show that, and improving nasal airflow. I know that there's research to show some CBCT data that have some papers that I've read where it's resulted in an elevated tongue posture, and I think yeah, so I think all of those can help with OSA and yeah, so I think sometimes my internet, I think, because what happens is that my I don't know my internet sometimes. The signal's not very good, and usually my wife is here, and I can just hotspot her mobile, but she's away in New Zealand, so I can't. Well, she can't use the
That's
thing
all
as
right.
a backup. Sorry, man, I don't have
All good.
Wi-Fi.
Well, that's not a problem. Sorry about that.
No.
All right. No, that's very interesting. So research is starting to show a little bit more how, orthodontics is interrelated to the whole, I guess, structure of nasal and breathing and everything.
Exactly. I think we need more long-term data. My understanding is that we need more long-term data. I mean, for speaking specifically about the long-term skeletal changes with, following maxillary expansion, like, first of all, we know that in the short term, not all the expansion you get is skeletal, so it's probably somewhere between, 25 to 50% in the short term, and then in the long term, we know we lose some of it, and so I think that'll be really interesting to see, like, in the long term, after 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, like, how much of that the benefits are sort of retained.
Awaiting that data. And I guess like the fact that you mentioned the CBCT superimposition, that would be very helpful as well,
I think so. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
The more works needs to be. I mean, it's a again, it's there's some complexities with CBCD superimposition, but I think it's about finding that stable landmark. And when I sort of did my research, it's, sort of hard to know what to superimpose. Anyway, yeah,
Especially if everything's growing, right? Like,
everything's growing, yeah.
you're
Everything's
putting
growing,
waves.
yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Cool.
Yeah.
Another question was, how do you typically deal with a non-compliant aligner patient? So we all love those, don't
No, we do.
we?
look, I actually don't think it's as bad as what I expected before I started practicing. I mean, I used to, for some reason, have the impression that like lots of people would find it really difficult to comply. But I don't know the stats, but I would say based on my gut feeling, like probably around 90% of my patients kind of okay. Like they comply. No, I don't know for sure whether they comply with exactly 20 to 22 hours a day, which is what I prescribe. But clinically, when they come back and I look at whether it's tracking or not, I'd say most patients would have no issue. In terms of patients who don't comply, like I try to ascertain that, from during the initial consultation. So I honestly will, ask them, hey, do you think it's realistic that you'll be able to wear these 20 to 22 hours a day? I think that the nature of their work is related to this. I mean, I had a chef who told me that, oh, Josh, I'm gonna have to sample food throughout the day. It's gonna be difficult. I had a clarinet teacher who said, look, I'm gonna have to play, practice and help my, play clarinet throughout the day. So those specific, very specific scenarios, maybe we should think twice about whether clear aligners, maybe is the best option. But in terms of look, in terms of motivating, yeah, and I guess the question maybe is more related to like how do we maybe motivate those patients to wear clear aligners. I don't know that there's a, maybe I'm not, I don't know whether there's a secret, secret to this. I guess one thing that I, sometimes I'll try to scare them. I'll say, hey, your package is going to expire after X amount of time. So, hey, we've got
That's
this amount of time. So, you've got to make the most of it. Or sometimes if compliance, or there's a few other technical things like, if I know that the compliance isn't very good, I'll slow down the movements. So let's just say I knew beforehand, they told me, Josh, I'm only going to wear like, and I've had patients say, I'm only going to wear 12 hours a day, 13 hours. And they told me after they started, but I might have them change the aligners every 2 weeks or just double the number of aligners, like order like a lot more aligners. I mean, those are some things that I would do, for non-compliant, or throwing them with braces, just say, hey, look, if it's not working, we have to put braces on, metal braces.
Too bad.
And then,
With those wires and elastics, you're gonna love it.
that's right. Yeah, so I think that'll work.
So let's say for that clarinet teacher, like, so
Yeah.
you'd have done braces. Would that have helped, I guess? Or
Well, I actually did clear aligners for her, to be honest.
oh, okay.
She it was funny, she was actually my teacher. Like when I
Oh.
she I didn't know at the when I saw her photos when she came, just before the consultation, there can't be that teacher who,
Oh
so when
my
I used to be
God.
part of the orchestra, she would she used to take our sectionals and anyway, but for her, what we did was we had to put the attachments on the lingual because she said that when she'd wrap her lips around the clarinet, it impact on, so braces wouldn't have been a good option for her because she would have
Oh.
felt it on her lips. And I think we just had her, I think we just slowed the movements down, to be honest. Like I knew that she wasn't going to be able to wear it, 20 hours a day. So we just compensated for that
Yeah.
by slowing the movements down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, in the end, and I think they're kind of realistic about it. And if if they know that they can't comply with 20 to 22 hours, I think
Gonna take my
they know that the results won't be as good as if they were wearing it 20 to 22 hours. So I think that's another point
That
to
makes
mention. Yeah.
Well,
Yeah.
that's true. Was she, has she finished the case, or is she still go ongoing, or
She's done. She's actually done.
oh.
I started her maybe, I think it took maybe, I think it might may have been 2 to 2.5 years. To kind of get there, but yeah, she's happy. So yeah, I still think it's the right, I still think she, clear aligners, taking all things into account, more suitable than braces for her.
Like saxophone would be the same thing, I'm guessing, or would it? Maybe
Sax.
slightly.
I'd imagine so. I imagine so. My understanding is that saxophone and clarinet are quite similar, single reed instruments, and the embouchure would be the same. So I think it'd be similar.
Yeah,
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah. I used to play the oboe, actually. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I don't know whether clear liners and oboe. I'd imagine it should. Yeah. I don't know. I'm
Yeah.
interested. Maybe I'll try.
Maybe
Maybe I'll try.
you can order a few aligners for yourself and try. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought about treating myself, actually.
Well,
Thought
that's
about
what I'm
treating.
doing at the moment, but
Oh, you're doing it yourself. All right.
I'm not wearing any at the
Did
moment.
you put your attachments on yourself?
Yeah. Oh, no. I got my wife to do it.
All right. Okay. Nice. So funny.
Yeah, but look, for those that are interested in applying for DCD orthodontics,
Sure.
they did ask, do you feel like having previous CPD experience or having done a course, is that a good thing or does it actually backfire?
Good question. Good question. I can't speak for all universities, and I don't know. And it probably really depends on who's on the selection panel. So I can't sort of generalize. I think that if you don't have any orthodontic experience, I don't think that's a bad thing. Like I don't think that will work against you. There's certainly like I had no prior orthodontic experience apart from placing space maintainers, and I know that a lot of other people were in the same boat. But by the same token, there were people who had done various orthodontic courses and still gone. And so I wouldn't say that it necessarily means that you won't get in or anything like that. I don't think it yeah I don't think it's a big factor either way. Like I wouldn't say that I don't think that people on the selection panel would necessarily see it as like an advantage in that they sort of start from the beginning and assume everyone sort of knows nothing, and then and so and so yeah I don't think it's a very big factor either way whether you have it or not, to be honest. What's probably more important is maybe other things like other things that, that you've done. Maybe if you've got have done some research or something like that, I think that would I know that some of the applicants got in through that. Obviously doing the primaries, it's generally considered, like I think most people, the vast majority would have done the primaries, and maybe just sort of generally sort of showing interest. I think they also want to make sure you're a well-rounded person. Because I remember when I applied for ortho postgrad, the selection the way the selection process worked was that we went in on a Wednesday. We were issued that we were sent some articles, like I think 1 or 2 weeks before, and we had to sort of analyze them. And so I think a critical appraisal of literature, I think that is something that they're looking for. Like if you can critically assess literature and point out the limitations in like research and things. So I think that is something important. And we had to answer questions on the papers. And they weren't even related to orthodontics. I mean, I think there was one on DNA, and then there was like
Oh, wow.
another paper on like bone biology. So it had nothing to do with orthodontics. And then one of the questions on the paper was if you didn't if you were to if you weren't a dentist, what would you do? What would you do instead? And so like I was completely unprepared for that. But what they don't want you to say is, oh, I love dentistry so much that I couldn't consider doing anything else, and I love dentistry for XYZ reasons. So they
Oh,
just want obviously want to make sure you're well-rounded and you have other interests outside of dentistry. That you're like a fairly normal person, you can talk about other things too. So
that makes sense.
and
How
yeah
did
so
you answer that?
I forgot. I actually forgot, like what did I say? I mean, I like music, so maybe I said I honestly don't. It's funny, like I remember the question in terms of what I said. I actually don't remember.
Well,
Maybe
it doesn't matter. You got in anyway.
it's such a terrible answer that
But you got in
Yeah.
anyway, so it must have been a
Yeah.
good answer.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
But
But
it
it got
does.
me thinking.
Yeah,
Yeah.
sorry, go on.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, no. What do you want to say?
It does. I mean, it seems like a lot of specialists did do a lot of the primaries and fellowship, and it does seem like a quite a hard, grueling experience, but also very rewarding. Like, what would you
Yeah.
say you got most out of that experience?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think it's worthwhile. And as I said, when I did the primaries and the final examinations, I at the time, I didn't do it primarily to get into orthodontics because at the
Yeah.
time I didn't know I wanted to do it. Maybe
Correct.
there was a thought that maybe I want to keep my options open, but at the time I was prepared to just kind of do it in that I thought in the early part of my career, this is going to take up a lot of time, a lot of time studying. And I thought that when I get older, maybe when I have kids, I won't have time to, do that much studying. I can do other CPDs, like, when I'm a bit older. But the value was for me, meeting other candidates, meeting other dentists and talking to them. And I think that had some role in it had some role in me sort of choosing orthodontics in the end. One other thing that, maybe I didn't think about when I actually went into it was like particularly to the final examinations, they sort of ask, they get you to think about what it means to be a professional, to be in this profession and your role in this profession. And so I think for a lot of our listeners out there, I mean, we can all relate that when, if we've ever done interviews to get into dent or med, and they ask you, why do you want to do it? And you probably say you want to help people, right? And then we all say it, right? But I think a lot of us actually do, we actually do want to help people. But I think it's easy to lose sight of that, when we and sometimes in the I know for me when in the early particularly in the early part of my career and even now, like I can get so focused on trying to improve myself as a clinician, improve my skills and my knowledge. But at the end of the day, I feel like it is ultimately to serve our patients and to help them. And I feel like we, it's going through the process of the final exams where I was reading stuff on that, it did sort of have an influence on me and got me forced me to think about that in a way. So that was one thing. And I think just the commitment to long-term gradual improvement, like I think those going through the process of those things got me to think about hey, like we have limited time, but maybe every day if we just do a little bit, if we improve in by 1%, like it makes a big difference in the long term. So so those are maybe some of the lessons that I learned. And also, we live, I think this is a very collegial profession, and I think people are generally willing to help out, other dentists, if you ask them to help out, if you want to shadow them. If you want to have a chat to them about basically anything related to the dentistry, most people are willing to avail their time. And I think if we all do that for one another, I think we'll all be better dentists.
I think dentistry we're quite isolated. It's a very isolating profession. But the great thing is that I feel like throughout my career and I'm sure throughout your career, as we go on to meet more new people, like everyone's so willing to help, even if you don't know them that well. Like everyone's willing to lend a helping hand or willing to talk to you about certain issues, which is I think fabulous for the community.
I think so. Yeah, sure.
Well, look, orthodontics can be quite stressful at times, I'm sure you know. How do you balance the stress and also your work and life and family, and how do you typically do that?
Yeah, that's that that's
Or do
that's a
you do
good question.
that?
Yeah, what do I do? Look, I wouldn't say necessarily that I've figured it out. I still very, very much get stressed by work. Actually one thing that I found very helpful was, I attended the Dental Practice Owners Conference
Oh, yeah.
a few months ago, and there was a doctor that gave a talk on the topic of I think it was resilience and strategies that we can use to basically be more resilient, to be able to sort of bounce back from adversity. And so I think one thing that struck me was the attitude of being grateful for what you have, because I think aside from the external factors that sort of make me stress, I think I have a tendency to sometimes, if things don't go, I think maybe as dentists, we want to control the factors, and if something doesn't work out, like we get upset and we get stressed. And so, but just being sort of, having the attitude that we have a lot to be grateful for. So even the absence of changing any of our external circumstances, I think that can help. But I have to say that, I'm sure we all feel overworked sometimes, and maybe we just need to cut down a little bit. I'm still working on that. Maybe think about how I can do that eventually. But outside of work, of course, I think having some work-life balance is important for me. What I do is I work from Monday to Friday generally, and so I've got Saturday and Sunday off. I attend church on Sundays, and so for me, I've been attending the same church for over 30 years, and hanging out with those guys, and having them remind me what's important in life has helped. Spend time with my wife, just relaxing. We just moved to Kensington, and so we're still figuring out routines. So now on Saturday mornings, we tend to go for runs. That's one other thing that I started doing. I started going for runs. I was really good in January. I was going like every day, but now I only run like once or twice a week. So, but at least I think if I can maintain that,
Still very good, yeah.
but I try to go to the gym as well. So I think that helps as well.
Yeah, so doing something that's not dentistry, pretty much,
Yeah,
to
I think so. I think so. Is that, would you agree? Is that,
Yeah,
do
100%.
you
I think
agree?
you can't just keep dentistry all day, then you'll actually go crazy at some point. And I feel like, especially, how you mentioned you go for runs, you go to church, these exposures actually make you a better clinician as well. Like, you often think of better ideas, think of better ways to interact with patients as well. Like, I don't think they're completely that different.
We're treating patients and not just
That's
teeth.
right.
And I think sometimes understanding exactly what patients want. Maybe that's one thing I didn't understand when I first graduated. I was so focused on what is the best clinically for the patient, which is very, very important. But I think you also need to factor in other patient factors as well, which you maybe pick up over time. And through general life experience.
Absolutely. Look, as we wrap up today's episode, if you could impart one final pearl of wisdom to the audience, what do you think it would be?
I mean, look, there's so much that could be said, but I remember when I first graduated, and even now, sometimes we're so consumed by dentistry that we see ourselves as sort of dentists only. And so I think remembering that, dentistry is a job that we do. It's very, very important, but it doesn't necessarily like define who we are. So yeah, maybe I don't know what people are going to necessarily do with that, but I think it does go back to that thing about work-life balance, and not only being so focused on dentistry, as important as it is to us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree. Like, dentistry, yes, it consumes a lot of our lives, like our working life. But I feel like there's so much more in life that we can experience and learn from as well, that we shouldn't solely base it on dentistry. 100%. Well, thank you once again, Dr. Chung, for dedicating your time after work, especially after a busy day of work today, to join us on the podcast. You've been
No
so
worries.
generous with your time and your knowledge and expertise. So thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Sean. Thank you.
No worries.